This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made.
All right, welcome to the show, everyone. People Speak Radio Show here on the BBS Radio Network. The website is thepeoplespeakradio.net. We got an interesting guest lined up today, William Pepper. He was an attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, the alleged assassin of Martin Luther King Jr. And his assessment, in fact, the assessment of the family members of Sirhan Sirhan, or I'm sorry, of MLK, Martin Luther King, is that Sirhan Sirhan is innocent of the assassination. That's interesting.
How you doing?
The family members of the victim, Martin Luther King Jr.'s family members, have serious skeptical views about Sirhan's guilt, and for good reason. So we're going to be talking about that today in just a little bit. We have a little bit of a delay. We were just in touch with him in the studio, and apparently he's caught up in some traffic. There was an accident. But he will be joining us in just 2 minutes as soon as he can make it home. He's just a few moments away from home, but there is some traffic. Anyway, but you don't want to miss this very interesting interview. In fact, he's authored a book on the subject, and the name of the book is An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. Very interesting book. I haven't had time to go through it all as yet. Wish I had more time. I've got a stack of books half a mile high here on my desk, waiting to be read, along with a bunch of other stuff I'm working on. So, unfortunately, I wasn't able to get through the whole book. But what I did read of it, it's very, very good, highly recommended. And anyway, but he will be up soon, so stick around. In the meantime, let me mention, anyone has any questions or comments for the guest in the course of the show, the toll-free number to do that internationally is 877-489-6350, or you can dial toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. I want to mention again, I mentioned this last week, I've written a number of different books. I've got one called The New World Disorder. It's kind of a broad overview of the current state of affairs that we're in, what's going on in this world and why it's happening. The goal is world government. It's a book that's thoroughly documented, so you can check my resources and see for yourself that I'm not making this stuff up. Unfortunately, I wish I could be proven wrong, but I've shared this book with thousands of people over the years, and you know, I've begged them, pleaded with them, you know, try to prove me wrong. I hope you can. Unfortunately, folks, as time goes on, that book becomes all the more true. We can see what's playing out right now. You know, today we had an almost complete pillaging of our treasury. The stock market dipped 777 points. This is all by design. They want to bring this country down to the lowest common economic denominator that they can before these scoundrels are out of office. If we even see the end of them, I don't even know. We might not even have another election, rigged or otherwise. They might be doing this to create a panic and have Bush stay in office. Oh, in the midst of this crisis, we can't have a change of guard now. So I still see something happening in the coming days. Anybody familiar with October surprises knows that it's usually in October that they stage something to, you know, rig a coming election, so they might actually be planning that. Anyway, if you want to read that book, or I've got several others, I've got another one called Piercing the Fog of 9/11. It's about the events of 9/11, showing that it didn't happen the way we were told. There's been a big cover-up. You can read those books and several others I have available by going to lulu.com. That's L-U-L-U.com. When you're there, you can just type in my name, Charles Giuliani, spelled Giuliani, G-I-U-L-I-A-N-I. If money's an obstacle, by all means, don't hesitate to email me at truthhurtsradio@AOL.com, spell Hertz, H-E-R-T-Z, and just tell me the titles that you're interested in, and I'll be happy to send them to you as attachment files, you know, for free. My aim here is not to make money so much as to get this information out. You know, people need to wake up and see what's been done to them for decades on end, folks. It's unbelievable. The crimes that this government has been getting away with, you know, killing JFK, killing RFK, killing MLK, which, again, we're going to be talking about shortly with our guest. They popped these people off, folks, because they stood in their way. They posed a threat to their monopoly of power and wealth. You know, JFK, we've talked about him on previous shows. You know, he wanted to shut down the CIA. The CIA is the right arm of the military. They usually send in the CIA jackals first to try to stage, you know, an overthrow of a government, an assassination, or some type of, you know, terrorist overthrow of the government. You know, if that doesn't work, then they'll send in the military. But this is what's been going on for decades. Our government, in the name of spreading freedom and democracy, has been invading countries on a scale that rivals anything known in human history. You know, we claim to have been against imperialism of England and France and Germany, and yet here we've been doing the same thing, far worse, but it's been done under the false pretense of, you know, again, spreading freedom. Nothing of the sort. Every country we've invaded since World War II has been designed to, you know, steal resources, set up bases in these countries, and turn them into compliant minions of the ever-expanding global empire. We've driven already poor people further into poverty. You know, it's very obvious, and it's disgusting. In fact, another guest, if Mike is listening, our producer, another good guest would be John Perkins, the author of, what is it? Well, he's written two books now, but his original one that really put him on the map was Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which is an excellent book. It documents how he and several others like him in the 60s, 70s, 80s were sent into countries in South America, South Africa, East Asia, third world countries, and they were told how to con world leaders in these countries into taking loans from the IMF and the World Bank. And as time went on, they would jack the interest rates up. If the countries were able to make their payments, you know, they would jack the interest rates so they couldn't make their payments, get them in a stranglehold, and then use that as leverage to bribe them into, you know, turning over their waterworks, for example, to a private U.S. and or British-run company that would come in and jack up the cost of water, you know, 200-300%, crippling the poor people, wreaking huge profits for those that ran the waterworks company. But the government was, you know, was strapped and had to agree to this to make the payments on the loans more bearable. It's unbelievable. It's blackmail. That's all the IMF has ever done, the World Bank has ever done. That's what they were created to do, is to get strangleholds on countries through economic means as opposed to military. You know, so ever since World War II, folks, this is what's been done. In fact, the IMF and the World Bank were created in what's called the Bretton Woods Conference up in New Hampshire while World War II was still raging. And the purpose was to manage the post-World War economy. And to do it primarily through getting countries into this trap of debt. And, you know, when you look back at history, since World War II, that's all that's happened. By the way, every country that we've invaded since World War II was done illegally. We haven't declared war on a country since World War II. And yet we've invaded over 60 countries since World War II. Imagine that. It's all illegal. The Constitution requires that Congress first declare war on a nation before the President can deploy troops. So this is one of the reasons they had to kill Kennedy. He was exposing this system. He was attempting to shut it down. Like I mentioned, he wanted, you know, to get rid of the CIA. He wanted to get rid of the whole, you know, Cold War. He wanted to bring it to an end, to reach a concession with the Soviets and stop this thing. He said, he realized that Vietnam was not in our interest. He wanted to shut down the Vietnam War. He was going to call home 10,000 troops in December of 63. But of course, he was shot in November, so that never happened. In fact, LBJ came along and beefed up our war efforts over there. But Kennedy realized that war was not in our national interest. He wanted to call our soldiers home and call the whole thing off. But the big Wall Street interests had other plans in mind, so Kennedy had to go. Not to mention, he was overriding the Federal Reserve by printing millions and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of greenbacks. Which were non-interest-bearing government-printed currency. You know, the Federal Reserve didn't like that because the money that we have is usury notes. You know, it's fiat currency. It's literally debt receipts. If you have a $10 bill in your pocket, that means you owe that $10 back to the Federal Reserve plus interest. So your money has no value because it's worthless paper, but worse than that, it actually has negative value. It's a debt receipt. That's why they call them reserve notes. They're promissory notes, promised to pay back a loan. It's incredible. And this $700 billion giveaway package was another example of that. The government was going to borrow money from the Federal Reserve, and you were going to have to pay back to fatten these crooks' pockets, you know, with hundreds of billions of dollars. We were going to have to pay that back plus interest. They ripped the public off in the first place. Where do you think that $700 billion went that they were wanting us to pay them, to reimburse them? It was stolen money. Anyway, I just got word from the station. I do believe we do have our guest. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, great. Yeah, we do have our guest, folks. So with no further ado, sorry for that little rant there. I was just trying to kill some time until our guest. I hope you did find it informative, though. Anyway, let me welcome to the show, with no further ado, Mr. William Pepper. Again, attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, the alleged, and I do mean alleged, assassin of MLK. Welcome to the show, Mr. Pepper.
Yes, thank you.
Glad you made it.
Yeah, I'm afraid we had a bit of difficulty getting here in time. For apologies to your listeners.
No problem. Are you still on the road, or?
No. I'm at rest at a landline for you.
Oh, great. Okay. I wasn't sure there. I thought I heard some noise in the background or something. Okay. Well, glad. I'm glad you made it home safe, and we can get the interview underway here. Yeah, so let's go back. I mean, you were right there at the time when this whole thing happened. Tell me, how did you actually become Sirhan Sirhan's lawyer? I mean, did you get in contact with him? Did you smell a rat, or did he contact you or his family? Or
well, Sirhan's former lawyer, Larry Teeter, who died of had a heart attack and died, had been in touch with me off and on the case because I had represented James Earl Ray for the last 10 years of his life and was involved in doing a shoe leather, as we call it, investigation on the King killing. So they had wanted to keep me informed on the Sirhan matter, and So I was familiar with. Then when Larry died, Sirhan's brother Munir asked me to consider becoming involved. And I'm not a conspiracy buff. I had been a friend of Martin King's, and a colleague, and worked very closely with him in the just that last year of his life, when I got back from Vietnam as a journalist. So I really had to be kind of persuaded, and they then showed me an enormous amount of new evidence that emerged that made it very clear that Sirhan was innocent of this crime. And so I agreed to take on the case and to move in the direction that we could finally see some justice and some truth emerge.
Are you actually still in touch with Sirhan? I mean, do you see him,
Well, he's my client. So I'm in very close contact as you can be with him, yes.
So the case is still, quote, ongoing. I mean, you're still trying to fight for his liberation? And
oh, no, it's an ongoing case, and we have a strategy to have all of the evidence actually put in a court of law under oath, and I think eventually the mainstream media will probably block, as they did in the King case. They'll probably block a good deal of the evidence. That's what they do. That's their job to affirm the established history. But I think it's the evidence of his innocence is so powerful that we're going to be able to overcome that. Now, does that mean that we'll ever get him out of prison? I don't know. I mean, these are very difficult cases, and sometimes the lock-in is very clear. But I think, in terms of the actual evidence, yes, we have a very good possibility of getting him out.
Well, at least he didn't get killed like Lee Harvey. You know, they didn't want him talking at all, of course, because his so-called victim was much more high profile.
Well, and, there have been very serious harassment and attempts on Sirhan. He is in what's known as SHU. He's in the secure housing unit at this point, and so long as he remains there, he's probably safe.
So more for his protection than concern like him escaping or something?
Well, it's not a question of him ever escaping. He's not going to escape.
Right.
Trying to keep him alive. They move him back into MHU medium housing. I'm afraid he would be killed.
What a tragedy, though. Here's this guy that obviously set up, and he's been in there for how many years now? 40-plus years? I mean, this is really sad.
Sirhan's been in prison for 40 years.
40 years.
For a crime he didn't commit, and you're right. He was set up, and he was used very much the same way that James Earl Ray was used in the
case. Sure. They do this all the time. And, you know, amazing is even MLK's own family members recognize that he's not the guilty party. They've even fought for his liberation, correct?
Well, they did after 1995 when my first book came out on that case, Orders to Kill, which was a work of frustration because we had so much evidence that had emerged and we were unable. I had taken his case to the Supreme Court. We were unable to get certiorari. We had a television trial in that case in 1993 on the 25th anniversary of the assassination. It took the jury 7.5 hours, only 7.5 hours to find James Earl Ray not guilty. And there was an unscripted trial. We didn't have a fraction of the evidence that eventually emerged. But the media blocked it, and so it became a struggle. The family, of course, was interested only in the truth of what happened to Marchand. So they, when they became aware of the evidence, and I sat with them for hours and hours and hours and opened all of my my books effectively to them, then they had no choice. They said, there's no question. We have to seek a trial for this man because only through a trial of this sort can the evidence come out. So the King family got on board. And, you know, I believe eventually the Kennedy family will. But that's going to take quite a period of time. So we have a lot of work to do.
So let's go back to the events of that day. And, you know, basically, let's talk about first the official story, you know, where they claimed that he was out on the balcony and fired the deadly shot. But then I want you to go over the details of, you know, why this story doesn't add up, why it looks like something else went on other than, you know,
which assassination are we talking about? We're talking about the King case?
Right.
Yeah. Well, Martin came to Memphis. He was supporting the striking garbage workers. There had been, he had led a march on the 28th of March, which ended in a riot. And that riot, we learned eventually, was provoked by out-of-state provocateurs who came into Memphis for the purpose of breaking up the march. They came from Chicago, Blackstone Ranger types, and out of St. Louis. So Martin was determined to come back to Memphis and lead a peaceful march. So he came to Memphis a second time, and that march was to take place on the 5th. He came in. They put him in a balcony room, room 306, which was out the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, rather than in room 202, where he was originally supposed to be, because that's a cloistered room down on the lower level. Up 306, of course, was a wide open room, and that switch was made in the days preceding his arrival, and he was placed there purposely. So he went about his business in the course of that day. Came in on the 3rd, went about his business on the 4th. Was to go for a barbecue dinner at the home of the Reverend Billy Kyles that evening, and he was meeting with the Invaders, who were a black power group who were committed to try to make the march be peaceful. and had been working with him. They had two rooms in the Lorraine Motel and had been working with him throughout. As he was there on the 3rd, it was a stormy night. He was supposed to speak the Mason Temple and decided not to. He was tired, and he sent Abernathy and Jackson, others went along there. And finally, the crowd was so restless and so anticipating Martin that Ralph got on the phone and called over to the hotel and said, "Martin, this is your crowd. You have to come." So he came, and that's where he delivered that famous mountaintop speech, which was the last speech he gave. Then he went back to the hotel. The next day of the 4th, he continued to work in planning for the march. And around about 5:35, he went up to his room with Abernathy. They shared this room, 306. He went back up there, and he was getting ready to go for dinner with Kyles. Now, James Earl Ray, the patsy, had been moved from Atlanta to Birmingham, Alabama, the day before. He had been told by his handler, a fellow called Raoul, to go and buy a rifle. And he went into a gun store in Birmingham where he was directed, and he bought this rifle with a scope, and he brought it back to the motel where he was staying in outskirts of Birmingham. And Raoul said to him, "You dummy, you bought the wrong rifle. We need a 30-06. I need a 30-06 to show to my potential gun buyers," which was the story he gave him. So here goes James back to the gun store, and he changes the Winchester he bought, to 43 Winchester. He changes it for a 30-06 Remington 766 rifle, brings it back to the motel, and Raoul says, "Fine, I'll pick it up from you tomorrow night." And that was on the 2nd. On the 3rd, he drives to Memphis. In the storm, Raoul comes to his motel outside of the city on the outskirts, picks up the rifle, and that's the last James sees of that rifle. Raoul tells him to go to this boarding house on Main Street, South Main Street, and meet him there the next day. And there's a grill beneath the boarding house called Jim's Grill. So that's where James goes, and James is then told that next day, that afternoon, 3 o'clock or so, to rent a room. Go up to the boarding house and rent a room, and then James does, under assumed name, gives Raoul the keys. Raoul then tells him to get lost because he'll be meeting some gun runners up there. James then makes himself scarce. He's out of the room most of the afternoon. He's told to go buy some binoculars, which he does. He doesn't quite understand why, but he does. Brings them back to Raoul. Then he's out of the room. So the afternoon gets wound down between this scenario on South Main Street in this boarding house of 422 and a half South Main, and across right to the back of the rooming house is the Lorraine Motel. The rooming house backed on to the Lorraine Motel. It was a vacant lot on the wall, Mulberry Street, and then the hotel. So James does what he's told. Remember, James is an escaped convict. And so he's been promised traveling papers by Raoul if he'll help him with certain jobs. And he's kind of duped. He's given a small amounts of money, and he's moved around the country. And here he is finally in Memphis. This is the place chosen for the assassination.
This kind of thing has played itself out so many times, you know, the way they set up patsies like this. It's just so classic.
Yeah, well, sure,
it's so
sure. Well, we now know, which we didn't.
By the way, I want to apologize for the confusion earlier. I actually mixed the two assassins up. I had James Earl Ray with RFK. I had it reversed, but sorry about that. Anyway, go ahead.
That's okay. Anyway, So this is these separate scenarios are playing out. James parked his white Mustang in front of Jim's grill. And this was the car that Raul had given him $2,000 to buy some months earlier when they first started using him as a patsy. All right, so Martin is in his room, and he's getting ready to go to dinner. Billy Kyles comes up to the door of room 306 and knocks on it. And this is at about 10 minutes to 6, about 5:50. He knocks on the door. Martin opens the door, talks to him for a few seconds, and then closes the door and goes back inside. Kyles walks down the balcony. He walks north along the balcony and stands away with his hands on the balcony, just as though he's kind of waiting. Now, I know all this because I got the police, eventually got the police surveillance records, and there was a very decent cop who was there watching all of this going on, and he was taking notes. His name is Willie B. Richmond, and I got all this information from Lieutenant Richmond's notes. He was a police intelligence officer who was at the back of the firehouse watching all this take place. So he reported what Kyles did. Kyles, on the other hand, has built a whole career and a phony legend about himself by saying he spent the last half hour or so with Martin King in the room, saying he helped him choose his tie. They were engaged in preacher talk. This is total and utter rubbish, and a total lie. But this is the official story that got perpetuated. You go to the museum today and you'll see this this carved in stone, effectively. This is what Billy Kyles, who's a member of the board of directors of the museum, has perpetuated. But it's a total lie. Mm-hmm. And so he goes down the balcony. Martin is waiting. Martin doesn't know that 10 minutes before that, there was a knock on the invaders' door. They had they were a couple of rooms down on also the balcony, and a woman knocked on their door. She was a housekeeper type, and she said, you have to leave now. And they said, what? What are you talking about? I have to leave. We're working with Dr. King. We're planning the work. No. You have to leave now. SCLC is not going to pay your room rent anymore. Your hotel room, you have to leave. They must watch you out of here. And this is all 20 minutes to 6. The evening, they say, well, you know, this is crazy. You know, people don't leave hotels at 20 to 6. Their room is already paid for the
right.
Next day, if
sure.
That's the case. So what are you talking about? They say, no, I just am instructed to tell you, you have to empty out your two rooms and leave now. So one of them said, Harrington said, well, who's given you these instructions? And they said, oh, well, the Reverend Jackson has given us these instructions. So he said he looked over. I interviewed every one of the invaders, by the way. He looked over her shoulder, and he saw Jesse Jackson down the parking lot looking at his watch a bit nervously. He said, but what? Jackson has nothing to do with us. We're working with the Reverend James Orange. We're working with Hosea Williams. Jackson's not involved with us. Those are the guys from SCLC who are running us, who are coordinating us. What is Jackson doing? They said, well, we don't know, but you have to leave. You're not wanted. And so they said, well, hell, that's what's going on here. We'll get out. And so they packed up their things, and they were gone within 10 or 15 minutes. They were gone about 10 minutes before the actual killing. So it was clear they were moved out of there at that point
sure.
in time. Okay, Martin comes out on the balcony at about, little before 6. Ralph stays behind. He's about to come out with him, but then goes back because he forgot some lotion or something he wanted to put on his face. So he doesn't come out. He stays back. Martin comes out. He's standing on the balcony, and he's talking to folks down below, and Solomon Jones, who's his driver, all these people. And meanwhile, across the street, James had gone down to the car at about 20 minutes past 5, 20 to 25 past 5, because he saw the car had a flat spare tire, and he thought he'd better get it fixed, because Raul told him to leave the car in case he needed it. So, and he told James, you go out off to a movie. So James thought he would get that flat tire repaired. So he drives away at about 20, 25 past 5. So he leaves the scene. He's driving north on Main Street, and he takes the second right, which is Vance. And as he turns the corner, two guys are crossing, and one pulls the other one back, and he almost hit them. And they identified him making that turn at about, 5:25, 5:30, a good half hour before the actual killing. Mm-hmm. Now, the affidavits from these guys I found in 1992, buried in the the lowest drawer of the files of the District Attorney General in Memphis. I found these two affidavits. They had affidavits from these two guys, Memphis Police Department affidavits and FBI 301 affidavits, statements, and, of course, they had never been introduced. They'd never been buried. These were eyewitnesses who saw James leaving the scene. James hung around this gas station to try to get the car fixed, the tire fixed, and it's just got to be too much. At one point, he hears sirens and police vehicles, and he's an escaped con, remember, so he thinks, well, maybe I should get out of this area. He starts to go back down where he was going to leave the car in front of the rooming house, and he comes up this street called Butler, which runs right alongside the fire station, and he sees the police have blocked off South Main Street north of Butler. So he turns left, and he's just out of there. He's gone on his way to Atlanta, where he's just going to get out of there. Yeah. Did not know anything about the killing until he heard about it on the radio.
Yeah, it doesn't like someone who's fleeing from a crime scene. You know, the motive that they claimed he had for wanting to kill MLK?
Yeah, so he's gone. Martin comes out on the balcony, as I said, and he's talking to these people. James is was up at the gas station around that time. Into the bushes in the back of the rooming house, right in the back of Jim's grill, where the whole plot was hatched by Lloyd Jowers, members of the Memphis Police Department.
Connected the FBI definitely with this, by the way?
Well, their job was just simply to cover up.
They
weren't involved in the assassination. They're involved in covering it up. I mean, that's the extent of their involvement.
Yeah, that's usually what they do.
So the sniper's in the bushes. Martin comes out. Lloyd Jowers, who owns Jim's Grill, is next to the sniper. The guy takes one shot, hits Martin. He throws the gun to Jowers, who runs back in through the back door of his kitchen, starts breaking it down right in front of Betty Spade, who had been his mistress for a number of years, who had worked as a waitress, and who was actually looking for him going through the kitchen when she heard the shot. And then she saw him running with this rifle, red-faced, into the kitchen, breaking it down. He said, "You wouldn't do anything to hurt me, would you, Betty?" And she said, "Of course not, Lloyd, I'd never do that." Betty was horrified. Lloyd wrapped the gun up, took it out front, put it under the counter. Betty was horrified. 1968, she saw this. She finally told me about it in 1992, December of 1992.
Is she still alive?
Because one of the reasons she did was partly out of loyalty to Lloyd, because she thought he was the killer.
Right.
She thought he did the killing. On the one hand, the other hand, she was frightened to death that, if he could do that, he could kill her.
So
she kept her mouth shut. So that happened. Martin was shot by a sniper who was a police department sharpshooter, and threw the gun to James, disappeared. There was another contact out there. It was a radio man who went down over the wall and was seen going down over the wall by several people, including Solomon Jones, Dr. King's driver, including another taxi driver who was picking somebody up at the motel. Coincidentally, it happened to see this guy coming down. And he fled up the street. He ran north on Mulberry, and he got
you know
into
what,
Mr.
Pepper, I hate to interrupt, but if you can remember that spot where you left off, I meant to go to a break a couple minutes earlier, and I totally forgot. But why don't we do that at this time? We'll take a short break, and we'll come back. And there's so much ground to cover. I want to get into talking about, RFK assassination, and I understand you have some aberrant views about 9/11 as well. I hope we have time to get to that. But let's go cut to that short break, and we'll be right back, folks. Stick with us.
Okay, that's fine.
Booty, do you want to get in here? Do you need to get here? What? You're okay?
As your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world food program.
We used to write letters to each other a lot, and it was intimidating to talk to him sometimes because he just seemed so isolated by himself.
She started talking about how she wishes that her life was over and she wishes that she was never born.
So I knew he had depression, but I didn't know it was that far. He
said something to me about killing himself.
Tell somebody, tell an adult, counselor, parent, whatever.
It's a hard situation because you do risk making that person very angry and losing their friendship.
It would have been horrible for me if she never talked to me again, but I'd live with it because I know she'd be alive.
Definitely worth getting help, even if you think you're going to lose a friendship, because it's better to lose the friendship than the actual friend.
Suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teens. For more information, contact the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, 888-333-AFSP, or online at afsp.org.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island.
Okay, folks, welcome back to the People Speak Radio Show. The website is thepeoplespeakradio.net. Our guest again this evening is William Pepper. He's an attorney for Sirhan Sirhan. He's been involved, he was actually a personal friend of Martin Luther King Jr., whose assassination we're discussing right now. Why don't I let you finish up with that? I hate to rush because there's so many important details here, and I don't like to miss any of them, but I do want to talk a little about RFK's assassination, of course, as well. But, yeah, if you can pick up where you left off with that, and then hopefully we'll have some time to talk about the other assassination.
Well, I mean, the folks who really want the details of the assassination and actually understand how it happened and who coordinated and who was behind it, should really read Act of State. Act of State is the second book I wrote on the case, and it's out in paperback now. It has all of the details of the trial. We had a civil trial. I represented the King family, and we sued Lloyd Jowers and others involving agents of the United States government, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis. It took that jury, after hearing 30 days of evidence, 70 witnesses, it took them 59 minutes to find that, of course, James Earl Ray had nothing to do with the assassination. Lloyd Jowers had a 30% liability, and agents of the federal, state, and city government had 70% liability. That was a remarkable finding by the jury, independent jury in Memphis, Tennessee, that most people never heard about. It's amazing. Most people never knew that trial took place because mainstream media has abandoned truth and integrity in terms of these kinds of cases, stayed in the hallway. Didn't come in, except when Mrs. King testified or Andy Young. Otherwise, they stayed out in the hallway. So
now,
what was the
motive that they claimed that James Earl Ray had for killing MLK?
They go all around the lot. One time they said, oh, he was going to get a bounty, but of course, he didn't even know the people who was going to give a bounty. Hold it a minute.
Unbelievable.
I'm going to move to another phone because there's going to be a little bit of noise here for a minute, okay? Can you hold on just a second?
Oh, sure. No problem. Well, folks, as you can see, this is so familiar sounding. You know, this is what they did with Lee Harvey Oswald. You know, they set him up. The CIA told him to, you know, work at the book depository, apply for a job there, get familiarized with the... Yeah, I was just mentioning how, you know, this is so typical. This
right,
I'm
with you.
Lee Harvey, you know, they set him up. They had him get a job at the book depository, and he didn't even know what he was doing there. You know, he just waited to get orders, and then all of a sudden, boom, there he is arrested, and he realizes, hey, I'm a patsy. So, you know, they have to get rid of him.
Yeah, well, those things, that's basically it's how they structure these things and how they use these people, and James... We now know, which we didn't know. I didn't know when I did Act of State. James was, his escape from prison was organized. And he was profiled as a kind of an ideal patsy. And they use cons this way apparently all the time. But certainly, James was used in this way. So let me
ask another question, and then we actually have some questions coming in too on the text I'm watching here. I'm going to read in a minute, but when we come to Sirhan Sirhan and RFK, did the same thing happen there? Were they setting him up ahead of time? Because let me explain. This is a problem I've always had, and this is something that most people don't ask. But apparently, JFK's motorcade route was changed at the last minute. He wasn't supposed to go through Dealey Plaza. And so how come people aren't asking, well, wait a minute, if Oswald was supposed to be his assassin, how could he have known to be in the book depository, he was working there anyway, but I mean, how would he know that he would have the opportunity? Why would he have had that sniper's nest set up with the gun ready to go if the limo wasn't even supposed to go down that street in the first place? And so when we come to RFK's assassination, I have to ask the same question. The plan to take him through the kitchen of the hotel to exit was a last-minute decision, correct? He wasn't supposed to even go through the kitchen. And so,
it wasn't a last-minute decision. It was a decision, in my view, that had been made 2 days before the assassination. I've come across now evidence that indicates very clearly that it had been programmed, it had been decided 2 days before, and Bob had agreed to go through the pantry. It was not generally known that he was going to do that, but he had agreed to go through the pantry. He had been asked to do that. I won't go into great detail at this point as to who asked him to do that, because that's still part of an ongoing investigation. It's very sensitive. But the broader answer to your question is yes, Sirhan, of course, was set up. But the Sirhan situation is much more complicated in some ways than James Earl Ray, in that Sirhan was hypnoprogrammed. He was and is highly susceptible to hypnosis, mm-hmm. and he had been very concretely hypnoprogrammed to do what he did upon a cue that was given to him by a woman who was controlling him at the time. He had no clue about why he was going to pull a gun and start firing it. He was a distraction. He didn't kill Bob. He was in front of Bob Kennedy.
He was actually shot.
He never got closer than 3 to 5 feet from the front.
Right.
Bob Kennedy was killed by a bullet that was fired 1 inch from the back of his head.
Mm-hmm.
This has been known for 40 years as part of the autopsy report.
Yeah.
He was hit with 3 bullets in the back, all with powder burns. They were fired at close range from the rear. Sirhan was always in the front.
Yeah.
There were 13 total bullets fired. Sirhan's gun held 8. We now have acoustical evidence, thanks to Bob Joling and Phil von Prague. We now have acoustical evidence that has identified 2 guns,
yeah.
the location of the 2 guns, the numbers of the bullets fired. It's quite clear that Sirhan did not kill Bob Kennedy.
Yeah, there's no question. I'm sure you're aware of the BBC's...
I mean, scientifically clear.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, the BBC just about a few months ago,
clear.
Do you remember?
Sirhan got off 2 shots before his arm was pinned to the steam table.
And so how do you explain all the bullets?
He got off 2 shots.
Right.
One of them grazed the forehead of Paul Schrade. The other went elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They were fired from the front. Schrade was behind Bob Kennedy. So this is all going to gradually emerge if we can move our way through the labyrinthian judicial process that serves often cover up these these facts and these injustices.
Well, I commend you. You're not only is it admirable what you're doing defending an underdog like this, but going up against, you know, such a monstrous, beastly system. You know, it's,
yeah, it goes deeper than that. What's not generally known is that I knew Bob Kennedy before I knew Martin King. I was Bob Kennedy's citizens chairman when I was a kid.
No kidding.
With a large political following. I was his citizens chairman in Westchester County, New York, when he ran for the Senate in 1964. So I have, I go back a ways with Bob Kennedy and that family.
Well, you actually sound younger than your age. I mean, not that that's that old, but you just, wow. So you really brush shoulders with...
Well, sounds are deceiving. But anyway, I worked out very heavily. I was a ball player, you know.
Ah, well, there you go.
I was a baseball player and a basketball player. I still play a lot of tennis. I work out very hard. So I try to stay as young as I can. I figure, you know, that's I owe that to my family and myself.
Well, you need that energy to fight these people, right?
Yeah,
but,
well, it's a tough fight, let me tell you.
Oh, I can bet. But that's quite an impressive resume. You've really brushed shoulders with some... did you ever meet JFK himself, too?
Never met him. I did write reports on his foreign policy speeches when I was a student at the London School of Economics and Political Science. I sent them to Archie Cox in Washington, and I was recommended for that by Henry Steele Comager, who was my professor of history, constitutional history and law at Columbia. But I never met John Kennedy. One of the sadnesses, I would have loved, of course, to have met him. I think, with a little historical distance, Jack Kennedy became a very impressive figure, emerging from late adolescence, if you will, to become a very serious leader. And His legacy is, of course, greatly missed.
Now, in your opinion, I have some views on this, but in your opinion, what do you think the real motive was for killing MLK?
Martin King?
Yeah.
Oh, Martin King was, there are two motives. One, his opposition to the war in Vietnam, which I convinced him personally to do, because I was a journalist in Vietnam, and when I came back, he saw my writings and photographs, asked to meet with me, and I then in the last year of his life, he became very close to him and really pushed him to oppose the war, and he did. That was number one, and that was going to go to the bottom line of major American corporations. So he was really cutting into their profits. That was number one. The other major reason was that he was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington the spring of 68. After Memphis, and there was an analysis by the Army, by military intelligence, that group was going to get out of control and would become a revolutionary force, and they didn't have the troops to put down that revolution in the nation's capital. And if King was not alive, they wouldn't be there, because only he could mobilize them, only he could bring them there. So they were never going to let him leave Memphis.
Yeah, he definitely was getting under their skin. Yeah, his speeches against the Vietnam War are just really powerful. And, of course, he had a hold on the younger generation, the very ones that they wanted to go over there and fight for them. So he was a force to be reckoned
with. Yeah, you remember 100 cities burned that year in America. 100 cities had fires and revolutionary activity. And there was almost a revolution in France in the streets of Paris. They almost overthrew the government of de Gaulle's last republic. And Americans were very afraid. American military intelligence was very afraid that King was going to do this. They were never going to let him leave. The army didn't kill King, but they had a sniper unit there, and they had two snipers, two spotters ready to kill him, and to kill Andrew Young, surprisingly enough.
And
they were there. The military was there to take him out. If the civilian sniper didn't do it, they would have taken him out.
Wow.
He wasn't going to be allowed to leave.
Wow. They were that determined.
Yeah.
One of the questions I have here, this kind of plays into what we were just saying. This is from John from the Canadian Rockies. He's asking, do you see both of these murders, MLK and RFK, as a preemptive coup d'etat? In other words, as a means of taking people out that potentially could have been elected to power?
Well, I mean, Martin was going to run as a third-party candidate with Ben Spock, and I actually was in charge of that campaign in 68, but he was not seriously going to, he was seeking a dialogue about the war, and that's the reason he went into, allowed himself to be pulled into the political realm. Bob, on the other hand, Bob Kennedy, of course, would have been president of the United States, in my view, and his presidency would have been intolerable. To the establishment and to the people who own America. He was not only going to end the Vietnam War, he was going to begin a totally new investigation of the death of his brother. He was the number one conspiracist,
right,
with respect to the assassination of Jack Kennedy. And he was, once he had the White House, he was going to go after them.
Right.
They couldn't allow that to happen,
exactly.
So he had to be taken out.
Right. Yeah, he definitely was going to win the election, there's no question.
And the media in America has covered it up all of these years.
Sure, still doing it. And so I guess in the last few minutes, that leads us to another question, 9-11. Here we're seeing the same thing again, aren't we? Regardless what actually did happen that day, it's clear that what we're told happened doesn't add up. And here we have the media once again towing the party line and insisting that the impossible is not only possible, but that is how it happened, and you're a crazy conspiracy nut if you question otherwise. But it, close inspection shows it couldn't have happened the way that we were told.
Well, there hasn't been a proper investigation of 9/11. I've not done any research on that. I'm not advancing any opinions with respect to what happened. I am simply saying, on behalf of the victims and the families of victims, that a proper investigation certainly needs to be done. And that's the only thing I say with respect to 9/11. And I've been involved here in New York in encouraging the development of that kind of a commission, independent commission. And there is a referendum that's gathering signatures and going forward for the purpose of putting this on the on the ballot in New York in 2009.
Excellent. Well, I want to wish you luck on that, and of course the other work you're doing with, Sirhan Sirhan, and how are his spirits? I mean, has he managed to keep a positive attitude all these years? I mean, that's astonishing. 40 years of your life are thrown away for nothing.
Well, it's not for nothing. What you have to do, you got to understand that. That a lot of people will tell you that, we're doing this for truth and justice and all of that. And of course, we believe in this republic and we're trying to save it. And you get all of that. So, but at the end of the day, this is much more of an existentialist, involvement. People do these things because for whatever reason they have to do them. For whatever reason it's important to their own sense of self, their own, identity. And their own creation of an essence as a human being, and if they don't do them, they're uncomfortable with themselves, and they get these pangs of conscience, and that's all I can claim. In many ways, it's a selfish action,
Well, I wish we had more selfish people.
That's what you do.
yeah. Well, unfortunately, it seems a rare thing in this country that people have a conscience anymore.
Yeah, I think they've been conditioned not to be concerned about these issues, and that's unfortunate because that's a tremendous loss of the individual self.
Right.
In my view, it is anyway. I mean, maybe they find meaning in their lives and in other ways, but to turn a blind eye to injustice and inequality and misery and deprivation that is that abounds in one's midst is to me it's not a way to live a life. But
I hear that.
I'm sure a lot of people have other value structures, and they do.
Anyway, Mr. Pepper, I see the time has run away on us here. I want to thank you for taking the time out, sharing with us. Maybe we'll have to have you on again sometime because we haven't even scratched the surface. There's so many of the things I wanted to talk about regarding these two assassinations, and time doesn't permit. But thank you for what you've shared. It's been very enlightening. And again, I want to encourage you to keep going in the direction you're going. You're doing a great service. Whether you think it's selfish or not, I don't see it as selfish. I'm very grateful for it.
Well, yeah, thank you for that. But I think let me invite your listeners to go take a look, if they're really interested in these kinds of cases, take a look at Active State. Read it carefully in terms of that, because that killing is symptomatic of the, you know, in my view, of the pervasive sickness that exists in.
Sure.
And the Republican has for quite a very long period of time.
Did you have a website really quick that you wanted to plug?
Well, no, there's a website called activestate.org that somebody has, a fellow has put up. I don't have one. I've never felt the need for one. But I want to encourage any of your listeners who have any information or any real interest or who want to become involved in any of these things, by all means, I don't mind if they write to me. My address is wpintlaws@aol.com. I always like to hear from people who perhaps have information that's useful, or you know, just comments that can be considered. So I don't mind people writing. So whether they do through you or they do directly is okay with me.
All right. Thanks again, Dr. Pepper. Really appreciate it. Okay, folks, that's it for tonight. I just want to remind you, tomorrow our guest is going to be Kathy Najimy. She's an actress and activist, most remembered for her role as Sister Mary Patrick in Sister Act, and also her voice character of Peggy on King of the Hill. So that will be tomorrow night. Next Monday night, my guest is going to be St. John Hunt, son of the famous CIA operative E. Howard Hunt, who made a deathbed confession on tape that he asked his son to release after he died, wherein he describes how it was a CIA, high-level CIA job, and that he was actually a part of the Kennedy assassination, a JFK assassination. So don't want to miss that next week. Thanks again, Mr. Pepper, and good luck to you. Okay, folks, have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Take care.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Called the Oprah of Radio by her listeners, award-winning host Dr. Pat Basile is blowing the doors off traditional talk radio. Get ready for powerful interviews with leaders in the field of human potential. Dr. Pat's perspective on living life full out has catapulted her show to the top of talk radio. Tune in, and Dr. Pat will help you thrive instead of merely survive. Listen to the Dr. Pat Show, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific on bbsradio.com and visit thedrpatshow.com.
She comes around here with a license to love. I don't know where she got it. I trusted you, offered everything, but I'm not sure you deserve it. You tell me that I'm lucky, but I feel like giving up. Cause a heart like mine's wasted on you if you don't know what you're throw it away.